From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The U.S. reacted cautiously to an offer by North Korea to halt nuclear testing and hold talks with Washington. The offer was made public by South Korea after its delegation returned from talks with North Korean officials, including leader Kim Jong-un. The two Koreas are to meet in an April summit. President Donald Trump said the U.S.-led global pressure campaign seems to be paying off.
They are sincere, but I think they're sincere also because the sanctions and what we're doing with respect to North Korea, including, you know, the great help that we've been given from China, and they can do more. But I think they've done more than certainly they've ever done for our country before.
However, a senior administration official said the North Koreans have earned our skepticism. That view was shared by the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats.
Hope springs eternal, but we need to learn a lot more relative to these talks, and we will, and the IC will continue to do every possible collection and assessment we can relative to the situation that exists in North Korea.
Vice President Mike Pence said the maximum pressure campaign over the North's nuclear program would continue. A U.S. official said planned joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises will go on as planned. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, ahead of a trip to Africa, said in a speech Tuesday, the U.S. approach to development assistance is different from that of China.
The United States pursues sustainable growth that bolsters institutions, strengthens the rule of law, and builds the capacity of African countries to stand on their own two feet. We partner with African countries by incentivizing good governance to meet long-term security and development goals.
Tillerson said, in contrast, China's approach encourages dependency. He's embarked on a one-week trip to Africa. This is VOA News. A Russian military transport crashed in Syria Tuesday, killing all 39 on board. The Kremlin said the cause was a technical malfunction. Meanwhile, U.S. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert Tuesday blasted Russia for complicity in the carnage in the besieged rebel enclave of Eastern Ghouta.
The strikes on Eastern Ghouta in recent days have demonstrated the farcical nature of Russia's proposed humanitarian corridor. Russia is clearly attempting to feign implementation of UNSCR 2401 while showing complete disregard for the ongoing humanitarian disaster that still unfolds.
A 46-truck convoy was able to make it into the town of Duma in Eastern Ghouta, where International Committee of the Red Cross spokesman Paul Kurziskit described a precarious situation.
People were telling you very desperate stories. They're tired. They are angry. They don't want aid. What they want is the shelling to stop.
Meanwhile, the UN Commission of Inquiry Tuesday said a Russian plane was responsible for the deaths of more than 80 people in an airstrike in November in Idlib province. And it blamed the U.S.-led coalition for a strike that took at least 150 lives in March. President Trump Tuesday remained firm in his view that stiff tariffs on steel and aluminum imports are necessary.
We have a trade deficit of $800 billion a year. And that's not going to happen with me. We have been mistreated by many, sometimes fairly, but there are really very few instances where that's taken place. And I don't blame the countries. I blame our leadership.
Later, economic adviser Kerry Conn, an opponent of tariffs, announced he'll be leaving the White House. The Speaker of the House of Representatives, fellow Republican Paul Ryan, urged Mr. Trump to engage in a more targeted approach.
There is clearly abuse occurring. Clearly, there is overcapacity, dumping, and transshipping of steel and aluminum by some countries, particularly China. But I think the smarter way to go is to make it more surgical and more targeted.
Mexico Tuesday vowed to retaliate with tariffs of its own. U.S. stock futures were lower on the news of the Cohn resignation and the prospect of a global trade war. The benchmark Dow Jones Index managed to eke out a slight gain in trading Tuesday. Britain is promising a robust response if it can prove Russia was behind a mysterious illness that has left a former Russian spy fighting for his life. Police are trying to determine the nature of the substance that felled Sergei Skripal and his daughter Sunday in Salisbury. Sri Lanka remains under a week-long state of emergency, a bid to quell communal violence between majority Buddhists and minority Muslims. Sinhalese mobs targeted Muslim properties in eastern and central Sri Lanka, prompting the declaration. And Amazon chief Jeff Bezos remains the world's richest person, according to Forbes magazine, replacing Microsoft founder Bill Gates. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Togo's opposition will resume anti-government protests next week, despite ongoing talks with Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo.
Basically, because the government party did not fulfill the requirement they agreed upon for the appeasement measures.
Kodjo Delava is the Secretary General of Togo's main opposition National Alliance for Change Party. Gambian doctors are calling for the resignation of the country's health minister. South Sudan's government rejects a new report accusing officials of financially benefiting from the country's ongoing conflict. And mounting inter-ethnic tensions in the DRC's Kasai region threaten new violence.
We are in contact with the authorities to make sure that there are no further deportations of people of concern to UNHCR of refugees.
Akaterini Kitidi is a spokesperson for UNHCR. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is on a five-nation Africa trip. We'll speak with a professor of international relations. And the largest ever Lassa fever outbreak is spreading in Nigeria. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Togo's 14-party opposition coalition says it will resume demonstrations next week to demand the resignation of President Faure Gnassingbé. This despite ongoing talks brokered by Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo. The protesters are demanding a return to the country's 1992 constitution, which established a two-term limit for the presidency. President Gnassingbé, in power since 2005, is proposing a referendum to change the constitution to a 2 5-year term of office, retroactive. Kodjo Delava is Secretary General of Togo's main opposition National Alliance for Change Party. He says the protest will resume because the government broke the agreement it signed that first led to suspension of the protests.
Number one, instead of achieving or completing the appeasement measure, they have the army surround a village we call Paratau. Paratau is the native village of one of the PMP leaders. Last Saturday night, they surrounded this village and they beat anyone who was entering or going out of this village. It was unbelievable. Number two, everybody agreed upon not continuing the electoral process. That is, there was a recommendation of the facilitation asking to the government to not go in on the electoral process unilaterally. But last week, the Council of the Minister signed a decree to appoint the president of the local electoral commission. This is unacceptable by the group of the 14 political parties. So they decided to resume with the manifestation next week.
Mr. Delava, in the meantime, the talks between the opposition and the government are going on. We understand that President Nana Akufo-Addo has invited you, the opposition, and the government back to Accra. Now, how are those talks going?
When the last meeting was adjourned, the facilitation said they will call on any of the parties for consultation. And that's what is going on now. So President Nana Akufo-Addo invited the opposition parties as well as the ruling party and the government to Accra for consultation. We don't know the subject of this consultation because the meeting will be held tomorrow.
One point of contention in the ongoing discussions has been that President Faure Gnassingbé would like to go on or have another term. Is that something that the opposition is willing to accept?
This is a point in the air, but the opposition make it clearly that this will be unacceptable. No way the President Faure Gnassingbé will have again the opportunity to have another term. The current term should be the last term of Paul Nasingbe.
So the term of President Paul Nasingbe, when does it come to an end?
It will normally come to an end in 2020. But people do not want him to go as far as 2020. What people are demonstrating for is an immediate end of Mr. Nasingbe's rule.
In fact, there's a referendum that has been scheduled for the people of Togo to decide what's next. Do you back that referendum?
No, the opposition political party does not agree with this idea of a referendum. They said this regime mismatched the constitution.
Kojo Delava is the Secretary General of Togo's main opposition, National Alliance for Change Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lomé. Medical doctors in the Gambia are calling for the resignation of the country's health minister, Mrs. Safi Lo Cisse. The doctors say they will embark on a sit-down strike if the minister does not resign within 24 hours. The doctors are apparently infuriated by the health minister's accusation that doctors have been stealing government-supplied drugs to operate private pharmacies. VOA's Pandere Umbaye reports.
The voices of Gambian doctors on Tuesday during a press conference organized by the Gambia Resident Doctors Association. This followed damning corruption allegations made by Health Minister Safi Lo Cisse against Gambia's medical fraternity. She told journalists during a recent West African College of Surgeon press conference held in Banjul that efforts to develop the Gambia have been held back by corrupt and unpatriotic doctors. The Standard newspaper in the Gambia quoted the health minister as having said that some of the doctors are operating private pharmacies at the expense of the limited resources at the health facilities. Dr. Ibrahim Abba is the president of the Gambia Resident Doctors Association.
The only role a medical doctor plays is prescribing. He or she is not in any way involved in the procurement or dispensing of drugs. If the minister doesn't understand the basic from budgeting, drug procurement down to dispensing, then it shows her incompetence at her job.
Dr. Ban knows that the Gambia is a limited resource-based country, but pointing accusing fingers will not solve the situation. He called on the health minister to assume full responsibility for the country's recent health challenges.
It is the responsibility of the minister and her administration to prepare proper and comprehensive budget proposal for the health sector and also ensure a wise and transparent allocation is done in all health areas.
Gambia's health sector is in a state of crisis. There are limited drugs in government hospitals while health facilities are decaying. Dr. Ibrahim Abba again.
In conclusion, the entire membership of GAD, 191 doctors, unanimously agreed that following her recent comment and considering our ailing health system, we have no confidence in her leading us as the Minister of Health and Social Welfare.
Dr. Abba maintains that the minister's allegations are not only false, but totally unfounded. Hence, he has laid down a set of demands from the Doctors Association.
We therefore, in this regard, demand that one, the minister retracts her statement immediately. Two, apologizes to the entire medical and health fraternity. And three, immediately appeals her resignation within 48 hours. Or we respond with a sit-down strike if these demands are not met.
Public strike is becoming a routine thing in the new Gambia, as it is widely called. Last month, some teachers embarked on a sit-down strike, demanding for pay raise among other incentives. For VOA Daybreak Africa.
Today is Wednesday, March 7th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The South Sudan government is dismissing a report by the Sentry, an initiative of the Washington-based Enough Project, which accuses top government officials of financially benefiting from the country's ongoing conflict. According to the report, the officials include South Sudan First Lady Mary Ayen Maradit. The report says says $80 million from oil proceeds were paid to top government officials who own companies that are providing services to the South Sudan Army. But Michael Makui, South Sudan's government spokesman and information minister, says the report is meant to tarnish the image of President Salva Kiir's family.
This is a very clear case of defamation, because ENAF is an organization which was set up in order to tarnish the image of the president and his family, the government, and the people of South Sudan. All that appeared in that report are unacceptable. They are not true. They are just lies. This is what President Trump refers to as fake news.
Mr. Minister, I think the authors of this report, they stand by this report, and they said that their findings can be substantiated. So let me give you one key finding here. It says more than $80 million was recorded as paid to South Sudanese politicians, military officials, government agencies. One of the people named there is the First Lady Mary Ayen Mayard. Reportedly received
that
six
is,
payments
that is nonsense.
Beginning.
These are the reports which I say they are actually meant to tarnish the image of the president and his family. And we know the source of all these informations. Even ENAF is becoming corrupt because ENAF is not that ENAF which we know earlier. So all these are issues which are meant to tarnish the image of the First Lady.
They're recommending going after those individuals who are apparently involved or allegedly involved in this practice, mean setting up these companies through which money is paid to fuel the military movement, the war.
These are all these tactics meant to, in order to fail the government, to tell the people that this government is destroying your wealth, this government is doing what, this government is doing this. After all, if you have been following the prices of oil in the market earlier, did we really have that enough which can make us to pay this huge amount to everybody?
Minister, so this is a denial that your government is saying that this did not...
It is a statement of fact. It is not a denial.
Was your government informed or given a copy of this report?
We are not yet informed, but I'm responding to what I'm hearing from you.
So your government isn't concerned about possible financial sanctions on your government or individuals connected with your government?
What the American government is already out to ensure that the government of South Sudan is made to fail by any possible means. This is a clear thing. We know it very well. So whatever sanctions that the Americans are out to do, they are already on the way. So there is nothing new.
I think what everybody wants is for the leadership in South Sudan to do everything possible to end the conflict there.
Who is that, everybody? Is the American approach the right way in order to bring the conflict to an end in South Sudan? In fact, they are fueling the war more than any other person. And it is because of their declaration before we went for the peace talks that made the rebels to be intransigent and not listening to the government, not ready for any peace to be achieved in South Sudan.
Isn't it true that your government did not, at the recent talks in Addis Ababa, that there was a disagreement between your government and the rebels? So I don't think it's fair to blame the international community.
It is the international community, because it is they who were behind all this. They were on the driving seat. The parties were not left alone to decide for themselves.
Michael Makui, South Sudan's government spokesman and information minister, you're speaking with me from the capital, Juba. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is on a five-nation Africa trip that will take him to Ethiopia, Djibouti, Kenya, Chad, and Nigeria. Before leaving, Secretary Tillerson spoke Tuesday in Washington and promised $533 million in new aid to Africa. He touted U.S. efforts to improve access to electricity across Africa, as well as provide critical drugs for millions of people to treat HIV/AIDS. Secretary Tillerson's trip comes months after President Donald Trump ridiculed some African countries. John Strimlow is a visiting professor of international relations at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. He has just written an article in which he gave three reasons why Africa should be skeptical of Secretary Tillerson's visit.
Tillerson is going to only five countries across the arc of instability, so it's geographically very limited. Secondly, it is really about counterterrorism. The third reason is really whatever Tillerson says in this regard is questionably credible, because he has been undercut so often by his commander-in-chief, Donald Trump. And so therefore, I think governments in Africa have a very hard problem deciding how much weight to give whatever this Tillerson trip comments upon or says.
The State Department, they say here that during Tillerson's visit, he's going to meet with officials at the African Union to discuss partnership. Okay, you mentioned the terrorism, but to advance peace and security and to promote good governance. This is good if it happens.
Well, yes, and I'm for cooperation, of course, but bear in mind that the African Union meeting with the leaders there is the only opportunity that he really has to speak broadly about the norms and changes that are occurring across the continent. And this is at a period when the U.S. influence and role in Africa has declined dramatically since the days of Barack Obama.
So how do you think the African leaders that Tillerson is going to meet and even people at the African Union, how do you think they should react to Mr. Tillerson?
Well, I think in the first instance, let's recall that when Donald Trump made that terribly vile comment about African countries in conjunction with immigration, that the African Union spokesperson and others around the continent generally replied in a very, I thought, low-key and more in disbelief, you know, is this really the America that we had come to work with? You know, we all have our differences on foreign policy issues, but I felt that the bipartisan support in the Congress for at least programs in agricultural development, alternative energy, and of course, public health made a big difference, and I think we're welcomed in the continent. There was often a lot of debate about whether the U.S. was being too active in promoting good governance and democracy. Those are sensitive issues for any country, of course. The African Union takes elections very seriously now and monitors all of them. But Trump and Tillerson show no interest in any of these. And I think the Africans can respond best by just saying, what are you doing? Why is America shirking its partnerships and making life so complicated out here when it doesn't have to be that way? We can have a decent partnership, but all you're doing is causing us headaches, and you're also betraying what you say are your core values. I mean, that's what I think is the high road.
Professor Strimlow, you also said here that you believe that Africa should also remind Secretary Tillerson of Africa's appreciation of China's increasing importance. What exactly do you mean?
Because China is becoming a much more important partner for Africa, and China is an authoritarian state, but it is doing a lot of important and useful work for development in Africa, and it doesn't tell the Africans what to do. It just tries to work out arrangements that are mutually beneficial, which is the way to proceed. And I would like to see more of that happening with regard to America, but I don't think it will under Donald Trump and Rex Tillerson.
John Strimlow is a visiting professor of international relations at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. He was speaking with me from Johannesburg. The UN Refugee Agency says mounting inter-ethnic tension in the Kasai region of the Democratic Republic of Congo is threatening to plunge the region into renewed violence with fears of more civilian displacement. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Last month, inter-ethnic fighting caused more than 11,000 people to flee their homes in the northern part of the Kasai. The number is insignificant when compared to the 900,000 Congolese who have become internally displaced since the Kasai crisis erupted in 2016. But the UN Refugee Agency takes the situation very seriously. It notes Congolese government forces have regained control of large areas of the Kasai, but it says sporadic fighting between the armed forces and militia groups continues as ethnic tension grows and more people flee. An additional complication concerns more than 35,000 people who have fled to Angola. UNHCR spokeswoman Ekaterina Kititi says her agency only recently learned that Angola has forcibly deported some 530 Congolese between February 25 and 27. She tells VOA she does not know why the Angolan government took the action.
We are in contact with the authorities to make sure that there are no further deportations of people of concern to UNHCR of refugees. We have reiterated in our talks with the government counterparts the need to respect the international principles principles, and we continue to monitor the situation in Angola, while noting that protection and humanitarian assistance for the returnees in DRC is indeed very challenging due to security and funding difficulties.
Since September, Kititi says some of the refugees have returned spontaneously to the Kasai, only to find it impossible to regain their former homes. She says many found their homes have been burnt down and their property looted. She says many are living in churches and mosques, while others are forced to move to different provinces. She says the UNHCR would like to help the returnees rebuild their homes, but that is not possible because the agency has received just 1% of the $369 million it needs to help people affected by the DRC crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The largest ever Lassa fever outbreak is spreading in Nigeria as Nigeria's Center for Disease Control posts the number of suspected cases since January this year at more than 1,100. The health organization Alima is on the ground treating patients. The group's emergency coordinator for the Lassa fever response, Lorenza Pomarico, spoke to Ricky Stryak from Ondo State in Nigeria, the heart of the epidemic.
This is by far the largest outbreak on record. As you know, it's an endemic disease here in Nigeria, which means that every year there is an outbreak. But this time, in 2018, the scale has been unprecedented. Just to give you an idea, in January 2018, there has recorded more confirmed cases than in the whole year 2017. And then the first 2 weeks of February, we had more confirmed cases across the country. It's been an exponential growth in the number of cases, by far the largest on record, at least.
What about the mortality rate? Is that higher than past recorded outbreaks of Lassa fever in the region?
Mortality rate, as far as I know, that is usually around 30%, provided that there is no assistance at all. That's a 30% mortality rate, which is very high as such. Still does not compare with Ebola, which was closer to 80%. But as far as I know, this year has not been any different in regard to that. So again, the main difference is the sheer scale of the outbreak.
Is it continuing to spread? Are there concerns that it's spreading quicker than can be contained?
So the outbreak has been spreading. It's affecting many states in Nigeria. However, most of the cases are in three states. That's Ondo, Edo, and Ebonyi state. This is why Alima deployed in the first two, Ondo and Edo states. Basically, it's been spreading. What I can tell you is that Edo and Ondo, between EP week 7 and EP week 8, week 8 is last week, we had a reduction in the number of cases. We have been seeing less confirmed cases. Do not know as of now why. It can be many reasons, and that just adds to the complexity of the response, because usually the rains are a factor which contributes to decrease the number of cases, but we are not in a measure to prove that. It can also be that people are actually scared to go to the hospital. And this is confirmed by the fact that both directors of the hospitals have told me that they're going broke, basically, because they have seen a huge decrease in the number of people who come and get treated across all departments. I'm not talking only about Lassa, but across all departments.
How are the health workers being affected?
One of the first indicators that an outbreak is bad and is going very wrong is when health workers start to die. So as you know, up to 11 health workers have been affected so far across the country, and 4 have died. That was also like the alarm bell rung and said, okay, we need to do something, and this is why we sped up and scaled up our deployment.
From the research standpoint, is Lassa fever a neglected disease?
Finding a vaccine would definitely be a very, very, very good thing. As far as I know, and again,
That was Lorenza Pomerico, Alima's emergency coordinator for the Lassa fever response. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Ondo State in Nigeria. And that is it for this Wednesday, March 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We invite you to join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as Post Editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good Wednesday.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, voters in Sierra Leone go to the polls on March 7th to elect a new president, parliament and local councils. President Ernest Bai Koroma is stepping down after serving two terms. His presidency faced the Ebola outbreak and allegations of corruption. An in-depth discussion on the most pressing issues facing Sierra Leone on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC. See.